how he would be positioned, what the intensity of the moment of singing the song would mean to the development of the play of the scene. And in that context, I approached music as a tool that was really about social information. It wasn't just harmony and chords and notes and melody, all that was obvious, but it was the content and the power of song. And having been heard in that play, in that context, I was offered a job to become a singer. And since I couldn't find other work, being a singer was a good challenge. So I put a repertoire together, walked into a nightclub called the Royal Roost, met guys like Charlie Parker, Miles Davis, and Max Roach.
They were your backup band?
My first backup band were those guys. And it just launched me into a world from which I have never looked back.
One of the incredible stories told in Sing Your Song is your traveling through the South and trying to sing your song. Talk about that experience.
Paul Robeson, who was a mentor and a man for whom I had enormous love and admiration, was the supreme example for me of how to use your life with dignity and with courage. Not bravado, but genuine social courage to put all that's on the line to come up against the forces of oppression who controlled so much of what you could or could not do as an artist, and to defy that fact and go after the larger goal of changing up the faces of oppression inspired me. And he went everywhere there was the opportunity to be heard, whether it was going into Spain to sing during the great Spanish Revolutionary War in the 30s, whether it was going to England. He worked with the Welsh miners. As a matter of fact, his whole engagement politically had been stimulated by what happened when he met the Welsh miners, and he sang with them, and he went into their world. But when I watched what he did and how many places he went for inspiration, and mostly places where there was oppression, I felt those were the places in which I would be most nourished with what I should be doing with my own art and with my own platform. And certainly going into the South of the United States, listening to the voices of rural Black America, listening to the voices of those who sang out against the Ku Klux Klan and out against segregation, and women who were the most oppressed of all, rising to the occasion to protest against their conditions, became the arena in where my first songs were to emerge. And in that context, going in the South was for me not to exploit commercially. That didn't come until later, but to find the resources to nourish my own creativity.
So there you were, the star on the stage, but you couldn't go in the front door. Describe that experience.
When I went to the South on a professional basis, I had already arrived at a place where there was some visibility. I was going with artists who were quite well known. Margin Gower Champion, a play called Three for Tonight. We, in many of the places we booked throughout the universities of America, a lot of the places we went were to the universities in the South, like Chapel Hill and the University of Texas. And in going to those places, we thought we were going not so much for the commercial reward of it, that's how we made our living, but to get the young people and to get our works before them. And in the places that we went, some of the auditoriums were public institutions. And when I got to some of these places, not only did they not want to let me in the theater, they didn't want to let me in the places in which we were booked to stay overnight. There were many instances where, by law, no Black person could stay in this hotel, or by law, no Black person could be sitting at a table with a white member of the cast, I mean white woman member of the cast, and not be sitting in the threat of incarceration and the law coming down on you, because these were the tenets of the law. This wasn't just something that was capricious, it was written. It was the legislation of the state, and we had to come up against that. And the battle was consistent. And even in the North, places like the Waldorf Astoria and the Palmer House in Chicago and these mighty institutions of culture that had strict race laws. And in accepting employment to go in these places, rigidly placed in my contract was the requirement that those laws and those rules be suspended and not be evoked during the time of my appearance.
Harry Belafonte, when did you first meet Dr. Martin Luther King?
It was right after Birmingham. I'm sorry, Montgomery. Right after the Montgomery bus boycott had taken hold, and the Montgomery Bus Boycott Association, the Montgomery Improvement Association. And we'd all heard about this young minister, and certainly we all heard of Rosa Parks. And I got a call, and before the strike had been settled, even. They had not expected it to run so long.
So this was in 1956?
1956. Dr. King called, and he was coming to New York to speak at the Abyssinia Baptist Church. There was, at that time, the head pastor was Adam Clayton Powell, who was in our Congress, and he was going to give a lecture to people from the ecumenical community. And he said, I'm coming to New York, and I'd love to have an opportunity to meet you. And I'd like to give you an idea of what it is that I do. And I was absolutely fascinated that he called, and I wanted very much to meet him. So I went up to the church to hear him speak. And at the end of his lecture, he would retire to the basement. And for what he said would just be a few minutes, almost at the end of 4 hours, we exchanged thoughts and feelings and passions. And at the end of that meeting, I knew that I would be in his service and focus on the cause of the desegregation movement, the right to vote, and all that he stood for. Although we understood how perilous the journey would be, we were not quite prepared for all that we had to confront. And I think it was the most important time in my life.
I wanted to go to a clip from Sing Your Song of Dr. Martin Luther King.
Dr. King, do you fear for your life?
I'm more concerned about doing a good job, doing something for humanity and what I consider the will of God than about longevity. Ultimately, it isn't so important how long you live. The important thing is how well you live.
I have some very sad news for all of you, and I think sad news for all of our fellow citizens and people who love peace all over the world. And that is that Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis.
Dr. Martin Luther King, and that clip is from the film about Harry Belafonte's life, about the history of the 20th century and coming into the 21st, called Sing Your Song. Harry, that relationship you had with Dr. King that went on for more than a decade until his assassination, how often did you speak?
I would say easily we spoke every day. Obviously, we missed some days or some weekends, but the line was constantly filled with thoughts and ideas and challenge and up-to-date decisions that were being made by a team of people that were always brought together when there was the moment to escalate what we were doing or to be cautious about where we were going, and also trying to broaden the base of our political relationships. So much of what our mission was doing was very dependent on our relationship with the federal government, with the institutions of justice, because our plea was on a constitutional basis. The Constitution of the United States of America is being grossly violated by all the things that black people are experiencing. And if you don't have the instruments of government and the federal government on your side, including the courts, then you really can't do very much, because all the laws that bound us to such cruel experience were state laws, and there was no way to appeal the injustice within the state structure. So we had to find ways in which to broaden our campaign to include a national movement, and it becoming a national movement, to entice federal intervention.
Do you know how many of those hundreds of conversations were recorded by the FBI?
I think my safest bet would be all of them. I don't know when it would have started, but...
Have you gotten transcripts of those conversations?
Yes, I've gotten transcripts. I've gotten some stuff from the Freedom of Information Act. What's very important is the fact that in the first 10 years of pursuing to get those files, I have letters that come from both the CIA and the FBI assuring me, with all honesty and without having done all due diligence and deep research, such documents don't exist. There are none. And eventually we had other sources that came through other ways in which they began to look through files and saw my name and situations.
Like Taylor Branch, the historian.
Taylor Branch, the historian. He was most revealing in what he had done with the research. But also journalists and other people who were digging to get stories on other subjects came across those files and informed us. And then finally, the FBI capitulated. And the first documents they sent, about hundreds of pages, 99% of those pages were just one big black stroke. So the insult against intelligence to send those kinds of files to a citizen whose rights were being violated was an insult to not only intelligence, but a crushing of the rights to information and to living in a society that is more open and transparent.
Talk about the march from Selma to Montgomery and who you brought down and the fear at that time and how these artists were also a kind of protection, the front lines, if you will, to protect the people who are at great risk, whose names were not famous.
I think all the artists who did this understood that there was the threat to life, and that some irrational person somewhere or some irrational group somewhere would find it very adventurous to mark them as one of the targets. There'd be a lot of heroism coming from the clan of these retarded people, emotionally and socially, to say they killed a celebrity, which in fact became in vogue not too shortly after this period. Look what they did to John Kennedy and to so many others, Dr. King and etc. But these artists understood that. It wasn't, they were not blinded by it. They weren't blind to it, I should say. And by putting themselves on the line, it heightened public curiosity. And in heightening public curiosity, it meant that things were forced to be more transparent. And they weren't quite ready to reveal themselves that way. I'm talking about the opposition. Except it's important to note that at the very night of our concert and the night thereafter was when Mrs. Liuzzo was murdered. And as a matter of fact, in the car in which she had taken one of the members of our group to the airport, she was on her way back to Tony Bennett gave up his seat in that ride.
Tony Bennett was there.
He was there. And we gave up his seat to someone else, to Mrs. Liuzzo and the young man that was with her.
She was a white woman who wanted to support the struggle, the civil rights struggle, by driving people.
Yes. She was a member of the Automobile Workers Union. And she volunteered to come down and was one of the organizers. And she drove cars to give people facility back and forth to the different places in which artists had to reside. And in doing that service, on her way back from the airport, she fell a target to murderers who killed her. That was to have been Tony Bennett's car. It was also important, I think, because the kind of artists that came down didn't have a platform in which they were going to be very visible. Singers could always be heard. But Leonard Bernstein came down. And when he and I spoke, Leonard said, "I don't sing. There'll be no orchestra to conduct. But morally, I feel an obligation to let my presence be seen and to let people draw whatever strength from that they might be able to garnish to know that their struggle is has touched all of us." So there are many who people don't even know about.
You also helped fund Freedom Summer.
Yes.
Talk about that, putting your finances behind the struggle. I mean, you now, what, in 55 or before, had the first gold record, Calypso, gold million-selling record. First one in this country. Some had singles, but you had the record.
Yeah, it was the first album to achieve the sales of a million. And beyond all of the hoopla that came with that fact from the commercial end, the studio and the record company, what was very prophetic about that moment for me was that it became symbolic of an instruction that Paul Robeson had given me. And he said, "Get them to sing your song, and they'll want to know who you are." And in that little exchange down in the dressing room at the Village Vanguard, I woke up not too long after that wonderful piece of counsel to understand what he meant, because that song, that album housed the song Banana Boat Day-o, and the whole world was singing the song in the literal sense. But also, when I looked at the thousands of people that came to the stadiums to hear that song and others, I realized that the world was singing my song. And in Robeson's counsel, this was the opportunity to begin to spread truth and to open up opportunities for information to flow. It was the opportunity to reach out to other artists who may not have been heard otherwise or needed to be heard, like Miriam Makeba. America knew nothing about the struggles of the people in Africa. Miriam Makeba came. She got the platform. Ed Sullivan was convinced that in his world, to let Miriam Makeba come on the program and to sing in Xhosa. And for him, it was an adventure. And he had been told by the programmers that they're not going to understand. And he said, "Oh, they'll understand. Harry likes it. It's good enough for me." And we got on the air, and there was Miriam Makeba singing these songs, and her popularity became quite intense.
Which was very important for the anti-apartheid struggle spreading into the United States.
Absolutely. Not only the anti-apartheid struggle, which spread in the United States, but for a greater understanding of the liberation of the whole continent. Because there was people like Sekou Toure and Nyerere and Tom Mboya, and all of the entire continent was awakened with the idea of liberation, and having African artists, eventually Huey Masekela and others, the whole idea of world music was seeded in the fact that the Banana Boat songs from the Caribbean, it opened up more music from Cuba, and the whole power in Afro-Cuban jazz and what those great Cuban artists did who pollinated American jazz with such great harmonies and song. All that stuff was a melting pot for a greater truth.
Harry Belafonte speaking in 2011 on Democracy Now! He died on April 25th at the age of 96 here in New York. Harry Belafonte, in his own words, stay with us.
Brother,
sung by Harry Belafonte from the Grammy-winning album he made with the South African singer Miriam Makeba. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue our special with more from Harry Belafonte, the legendary actor, singer, civil rights activist who died in April at the age of 96 here in New York City. Harry Belafonte last appeared on Democracy Now! In 2016 at a special event at the historic Riverside Church in New York to celebrate Democracy Now!'s 20th anniversary. He co-headlined the event with Noam Chomsky. It was the first time they'd done a public event together. Harry spoke about Donald Trump, who'd just been elected president.
I believe that Trump and bringing a new energy to the realization of the vastness of the reach of the Ku Klux Klan is not something that has been out of our basic purview of thought. The Ku Klux Klan, for some of us, is a constant. It has a constant existence. It isn't until it touches certain aspects of white America that white America all of a sudden wakes up to the fact that there's something called the Klan and that it does its mischief. What causes me to have great thought is something that's most unique to my experience. And as I said earlier tonight, at the doorstep of being 90 years of age, I had thought I had seen it all and done it all, only to find out that at 89 I knew nothing. But the most peculiar thing to me has been the absence of a black presence in the middle of this resistance. Not just the skirmishes that we've seen in Ferguson and Black Lives Matter. And I think those protests and those voices being raised are extremely important. But we blew this thing a long time ago when they started the purge against communism in this country and against the voice of those who saw hope in a design for socialist theory and for the sharing of wealth and for the equality of humankind. When we abandoned our vision and vigils on that topic, I think we sold out ourselves. A group of young black students in Harlem just a few days ago asked me what at this point in my life was I looking for. And I said, what I've always been looking for, where resides the rebel heart? Without the rebellious heart, with about people who understand that there's no sacrifice we can make that is too great to retrieve that which we've lost, we will forever be distracted with possessions and trinkets and title. And I think one of the big things that happened was that when black people began to be anointed by the trinkets of this capitalist society and began to become big-time players and began to become heads of corporations, they became players in the game of our own demise. I think people have to be more adventurous. The heart has to find greater space for rebellion. For such thought, because I was just recently reminded of Schwerner, Goodman and Cheney. They sit particularly close to my own feelings and thoughts because I was one of the voices that was raised in recruiting those young students to participate in our rebellion.
David Goodman, Andrew's brother, is here today.
I'm sure of it. He's always at the right places. But I think that there are those kinds of extremes that will be experienced in the struggle. But the real nobility of our existence is, are we prepared to pay that price? And I think once the opposition understands that we are quite prepared to die for what we believe in, that death for a cause does not just sit with ISIS, but sits with people, workers, people who are generally prepared to push against the theft of our nation and the distortion of our Constitution, and that for many of us, no price is too great for that charge. I've been through much in this country. I came back from the Second World War, and while the world rejoiced in the fact that Hitler had been met and defeated, there were some of us who were touched by the fact that instead of sitting at the table of feast at that great victory, we were worried about our lives because the response from many in America was the murder of many black servicemen that came back. And we were considered to be dangerous because we had learned the capacity to handle weaponry. We had faced death in the battlefield. And when we came back, we had an expectation as the victors. We came back knowing that, yes, we might have fought to end Hitler, but we also fought for our right to vote in America. And that in the pursuit of such rights came the civil rights movement. Well, that can happen again. We just have to get out our old coats, dust them off, stop screwing around and just chasing the good times and get down to business. There's some ass kicking out here to be done, and we should do it.
Harry Belafonte, speaking in 2016 at the historic Riverside Church in New York to celebrate Democracy Now!'s 20th anniversary. He co-headlined the event with Noam Chomsky. Harry died at his home in April at the age of 96 here in New York City. To see the full event, as well as all of our interviews with Harry Belafonte, you can go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Wandering Rhythms, Mondays from noon to two.
Join us in a weekly sample of music from planet Earth.
The strangest mixtape you will ever hear.
Desert blues.
Balkan punk.
Latin funk.
African psych.
Pigeon rap.
And anything and everything else you can imagine, equally represented by all continents.
Because good music is universal.
Wandering Rhythms.
Mondays at noon on CJSF 90.1 FM.